Greetings, all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 105 in the book of Luke, chapter 22, and verse 38. This is the middle of the Last Supper. Actually, toward the end of it, supper was over. The foot washing is already happening here, though it's not mentioned at this point, but it is mentioned in John. And here they have a discussion, and God, that is Jesus Christ, gives them one of the final instructions that they should have a sword. And because there was a purpose for it, a few hours later down the road, and of course they didn't know anything about it. And so, in verse 8 we read, "So they said, Lord, look, here are two swords. And he said to them, it is enough. So they came to that supper with two swords with them. Anything wrong with the sword? Nothing wrong with the sword. And they didn't use swords, mind you. The swords they're talking about here, it's not necessarily that they go to war. You see, and they were always in the multitude of the 12 disciples. But, you know, you need a sword in terms of things that you need to eat, or wood, or, you know, chop wood before make for the fire. And sometimes you walk down the road in those days, a lot of robbers along the way, here and there, you know, when they were all by themselves. And so, you know, there was nothing with carrying a sword. It's what you do with it, you see. And, of course, people came to the point after that where they thought, well, you know, I should never have a sword ever. Well, here it is, the two disciples of Christ, and Christ said, it's okay, you have swords. You know, put it to the right use, it's okay. You know, you don't use it rightly, that's a different story, like anything else. Just like, you know, your knife in the kitchen. You know, the reason why you have a knife in the kitchen, so, you know, when somebody comes around, you know, you pocket them, that's one thing. But if, you know, you use it for whatever you need to in the kitchen, that's a different story. So it's not the thing, it's what you use it for that counts. And so he said, well, that's enough. Two swords, that's enough. So I'll do the job. Verse 39, coming out, he went to the Mount of Olives as he was accustomed, and his disciples also followed him. When he came to the place, he said to them, pray that you may not enter into temptation, knowing what is going to, you know, to happen very soon. And of course, again, they still are in the dark, don't know what's going to happen. And he was withdrawn from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt down and prayed. As earlier, more details are given there, that he went and prayed for about an hour, and he asked him, in the meantime, to watch with him, pray with him, you see, wherever they were, and of course they fell asleep. And so he went, saying, Father, if it is your will, this cup, take this cup away from me, nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. And that basically was the final statement that he made, that is, when he prayed to the Father. This is not the essence of the prayer. You see, he prayed to him, and you know, there was a lot of going on there. And he was in terrible, terrible state of grief and anguish, and you know, he knew exactly what was coming. It was not easy for him. Still, you know, being human being, flesh and blood, and pain and suffering, and all those kind of things. And the fact that he had to endure until the end, never lashed back, knowing exactly what was going to happen to him, to his body. And he had to overcome that, and he could not use his power to avert this problem, because he had to submit to it all the way to the end. That was a plan. Both of them, the Father and him, were planning it a long, long time in advance. And he had to go through it. But still, he became flesh and blood, like we are, and he was tempted in everything, just like we are. And so he understands how it feels. And so he understands how it feels when we are in pain and suffering and sorrow and grief and sickness and disease and things like that. So he can be an extremely merciful high priest. And he understands also human frailty and weakness. And so we read here in verse 43, then an angel appeared to him. And so an angel is sent from God to, you know, from heaven. And so we read here in verse 43, then an angel appeared to him from heaven. The others didn't see him. He didn't see the angel because he went away from the others. And besides, you know, they fell asleep, as we read in the other account. And so here this angel appears to him from heaven, strengthening him. Either Michael or Gabriel, probably. And, you know, encouraging him. Verse 44, and being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. So the Father knew exactly what he needed at the moment, and he sent him an angel. He literally needed somebody to come and encourage him. His own disciples were asleep instead of praying with him. You see, they were not encouraging him. To begin with, they didn't know what was happening. And God needed to send an angel. Jesus Christ needed somebody to come and comfort him. And so he knows what it feels, you know, when we go through horrible trials. And now and then he sends us sometimes a literal angel, and other times other people to come and comfort us and strengthen us in our trials so that we can make it. And so he came and strengthened him, encouraged him, uplifted his spirits, and reminded him, you know, of all the glory and majesty and all the plan, you know, all kind of things like that. We don't know how long it was. And being in an agony, still, you know, in spite of that, being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. Then his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. So with all that encouragement of the angel, still the trial was there, and still his humanity was still there. You see, and so he continued that way, pleading with the Father if there is any other way. Verse 45, when he rose up from prayer and had come to his disciples, he found them asleep, that is, sleeping from sorrow. Now, what was that sorrow that they, you know, they were sleeping for? Well, you know, they remember what he said, you see. They remembered, you know, the betrayal. And obviously it was weighing heavily on their mind. They remember the fact that one of them is going to betray him. And, you know, in spite of the fact that they were tired and falling asleep, they still remembered all those kind of things, and that affected them. And so, you know, some people just, you know, when they're very sorrowful, you know, in a state of depression, they just fall asleep. That's what was happening to them also. And so they could not, you know, stay awake and watch with him and encourage him. Verse 46, then he said to them, why do you sleep? Rise and pray, lest you enter into temptation. So he wakes them up. This is what he tells them. You see, when people fall asleep on the job, that's when Satan moves in. And that's in essence what he's telling them, and that's what he's telling all of us. Always be vigilant, you see, because your adversary, the devil, is as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. And when he sees us falling asleep on the job, so to speak, that's the time when he strikes at us. And while he was still speaking, behold, a multitude, and he who was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them and drew near to Jesus to kiss him. And that was common still. You know, it's a common practice to this very day in the Middle East. You know, you come, you see a friend, you kiss him. And, of course, he also told them earlier that the person that he's going to kiss, that's the one. You see? Why? It is dark. You can't see well, even though they were coming, you know, with the torches, and they didn't know which is which. And so all these things were necessary to point him out of the crowd. Because, again, you know, he didn't look different than the others. Verse 48, but Jesus said to them, Judas, said to him, that is, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? Because he knew that that was the intent of it. It was not a greeting, you know, of a friend. It was a greeting of a betrayer. And when those around him saw what was going to happen, they said to him, Lord, shall we strike with the sword? Now they understood why he asked him to bring a sword. And oftentimes we function like that. When we do not rely on God, when we do not know the plan of God, we do not know the will of God, we want to take things into our own hands. You see, a lot of people do that. And there are people today that literally take things into their own hands in terms of guns and think we're going to protect ourselves from the government or from this or from that. You see? And they do not trust in God to do it for them. And so these two, they ask him, Lord, shall we shall we strike with the sword? And they do not wait even for an answer. And one of them, and obviously it was Peter, the, you know, impetuous Peter, tempestuous in nature. And one of them struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his right ear. Now, he was not going after his right ear. He was going after his head. He was going to, you know, cut his head off. And he just ducked. And so he got his ear. But Jesus answered and said, permit even this. In other words, don't do that. Allow this to happen. Allow them to take me. And he touched his ear and he healed him. So the ear is cut off. And he probably picks up the ear and he puts it back there and he touches it. And so you see, the last miracle, the last act of love, that he performed on this earth was toward an enemy that came to apprehend him to have him crucified. You see? That's when you begin to understand more what it means. Love your enemy. How many people were going to do that? You see, most people would rather have that person dead and killed because of what he was going to do. And that's exactly what Peter wanted that person. He wanted him dead. He was going to kill him. You see? Well, Christ shows the opposite of what it means, love your enemy. Why? This man is doing what he's supposed to do in accordance with the plan of God. You see? He's a partaker of the salvation of humanity when you think about that. He's a part of the process. Now, obviously, he's blind, doesn't realize what he's doing. And then God is going to open the eyes of this person. He's going to understand, and maybe later on he was. Maybe at this point when he healed him, he began to think about it. You see? But here it is, the person that he came to apprehend healed him. You can imagine that he's not going to forget about that. And who knows whether he ended up as one of the followers of Jesus Christ, because later on we read that an awful lot of priests followed Jesus Christ, became members of the body of Christ, and this could have been one of them. So while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And this is exactly what it is. And we have a very difficult time understanding it, and so we generally don't practice it in our own lives. We find it extremely difficult that somebody who hurts us, we're supposed to love him back and do good to those who persecute us and smite us and speak evil of us. Because we have human nature instead of the divine nature. And yet Christ commanded us to be willing to take our cross, whatever comes upon us, from government, from people, whatever it may be, and follow him. And that's how we follow him. We love our enemy. That's a part of it. Not only bear the suffering and the pain that they're going to bring upon us, but turn around and show love. You see? It's not love in terms of emotions and affections. You know, that would be fake. That's impossible. You see? But the act which he committed here of healing an enemy, that was an act of love. That's the kind of love that God commanded us to show. So we can, you know, the least we can do is pray, Father, forgive him, for he does not know what he's doing. Open his eyes. He says, this is a future brother of mine. And we don't think that way. And yet people claim to be followers of Christ when they do not follow him. They do not follow his example. And it's all charade. You know, that's what Christ said. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and you do not do the things which I say? You do not follow my example, not in your emotions and feelings and actions and deeds and thoughts, and yet you have the audacity of calling yourself my followers. And so he's going to tell to many, I never knew you because you never functioned like I did, and I did not live my life in you. Or else it would have been different. Then Jesus said to the chief priests, captains of the temple, here it is, chief priests are there, and captains of the temple, and the elders who had come to him. So all of them were in that group, including, you know, the soldiers of the high priest. These are all Jews. These are all his kinsmen. These are all members of his wife. These are all people for whom he was going to give his life for, as well as for others. So always look at it from his point of view and the point of view of God, or else you are not really comprehending and perceiving this. A lot of people in their bigotry and hatred and animosity and filthiness of mind and heart, every year for centuries were going through this account at this time, and all they had in their heart is hatred, hatred, hatred against the Jew. You see? What happened to love your enemies? What happened to following Jesus Christ and having his heart and emotions and feelings? Where an enemy comes to, in essence, bring him destruction, he turns around and he heals that person. We don't have that attitude. You know, we're exposing our nakedness before God, and we've done it all this time. And people have been doing it, you know, by the hundreds of millions in the past many centuries, all claiming to be followers of Jesus Christ, when there are nothing but his enemies. And that's what he's going to tell them in the resurrection, and those who are alive at his coming. I never knew you, you know, because we behave like children of the devil, not the children of God. And so he's saying to them, Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs? When I was with you daily in the temple, you did not try to seize me. But this is your hour and the power of darkness. And because it is, I'm going to give in. I'm not going to resist. And so he did not call us to a life of resistance against the powers that be, but a life of resistance against the devil, you see. And we resist the powers that be, that only that tell us, you know, break the Sabbath or break, you know, the laws of God. That's when we resist them and says, no, we'd rather die than do it. But resistance does not mean, you know, we're going to take, you know, we're going to take swords and guns and we're going to kill you and shoot you. You see? So they have to understand what it means. People don't. And so they do their own thing, justifying themselves that they are the servants of God and they're doing His will, and they're not. Verse 54, having arrested him, they led him and brought him into the high priest's house. And John adds other details of what happened there also. You know, not every single one of them is a recalling, you know, the facts of what happened exactly. And not all of them, in essence, as they sit down to write these accounts, are inspired by the Holy Spirit to recall all the details. And so God is using different people to add the different pieces of the puzzle. And that's what it means, iron sharpens iron, you know. It's not that you say, well, you know, you didn't mention this one, and what's the matter with you, you know, don't you know better, or things like that, and we begin to smite one another and afflict one another and lacerate one another as a manner of many is. They don't know how to use the sword of God. It is the sword to edify, you see, and instead of that, as Paul said, you know, you should remember that, that knowledge puffs up, and when people are puffed up with that knowledge, because they know certain things or remember certain things and others don't, and so they use it to clobber others and put down each other instead of edify. You see? Love or charity edifies. And the purpose of the sword is to edify one another, not to lacerate and wound and bruise one another, and many people do that. And so God deliberately does that, and that's why He has all the members of the body of Christ, you know, all together, sharpening one another, helping one another, and so we should all have respect and honor toward everybody, because God does not use only one person and reveals everything only to one person. You see, some people say, well, God speaks only through me. You see, exalting self. God doesn't function like that. He makes it very plain. He called many prophets, you see, and sometimes even during the same time, at the same age, the same, you know, very period of time, and He did not reveal everything through one person, or He picks different ones, and He speaks through them. And when people don't understand it, we don't realize that God is the one that chooses the different parts of the body, and He puts them wherever He wants, and He inspires them in whichever way He wants. There's no such a thing of Mr. Know-It-All. If you get to that point, you're a haughty and an arrogant and a proud person, and God resists you because you're not a humble person. And so people like that don't like to let others, you know, talk or contribute or add to it. Well, and that's the very manner in which God functions. And so you see throughout the account, you know, the four writers here, as people call them, the Gospels, each one has different facts. They don't contradict one another. They don't say, well, I know better than you are, you see. They're all adding, you know, their bits and pieces of information. They don't all, you know, necessarily repeat the same thing as the others in every point. And so this is what you see here. And so this is, in essence, what you see through the entirety of the Word of God. And so this is what is happening here. Having arrested him, they led him and brought him into the high priest's house, but Peter followed at a distance. On one hand, he flees. On one hand, you know, he's scared. You see, on one hand, he claims he's going to follow him unto death. You see, and as it says, when they took him, they all fled. But then Peter turns around. You see, that's repentance. He realizes what he promised Jesus Christ. You know, and he feels very bad about it. So he follows him at a distance, not too close, you see. He's still not brave enough for that. At a distance. And now when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat among them. So he was brave enough to be that close, but not that close. And a certain serving girl, seeing him, as he sat by the fire, looked intently at him and said, this man was also with him. Why? Because she is a servant of the priests, you see. And she was in the courtyard, and that was the high priest. And the disciples, along with Jesus Christ, were here and were there, were in the temple and were in different places. And this girl happened to be in one of those places, perhaps, you know, several times, seeing all these disciples that were very close to him, and Peter was one of them. And so, you know, there she looks and she sees him and she recognizes him. So she looks intently at him and she said, you know, I think that, you know, you're one of them. No, she knows for sure this man was also with him, you see. And so we see here the reaction of Peter, but he denied it. That's how brave he was, saying, "Woman, I do not know him." Imagine that. That's betrayal. What happened to the statement that he made before that? Well, all of us are that way, and God knows that. God is merciful to us in our weaknesses and shortcomings, you see. Some people are more brave than others. People who would never deny that. They're human beings, but they're so brave and so courageous, they're not afraid. But most of us are. And after a little while, another saw him and said, "You also are one of them." Somebody else that saw him also with Jesus Christ earlier. But Peter said, "Man, I am not." Again, denying. And then after about an hour had passed, another confidently affirmed. You see, Luke is presenting it in a certain way that others did not. Confidently affirmed, saying, "Surely this fellow also was with him, for he is a Galilean." And I just listened to his accent. You know, he talks, Peter talks, and others talk. And they hear him, they notice, "Oh, wait a minute, you know, you're a Galilean. You see, you're not from this area. And Jesus is of Galilee." You see, they put two and two together. And so they accuse him of that. But Peter said, "Man, I do not know what you are saying." Again, he denies him. And immediately, while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. And, you know, some say the rooster, that's actually one of the temple criers. In other words, one of the people there, in other words, awakening everybody to the service. And, you know, there's a debate about it. Was it a real rooster? Because in Jerusalem, generally speaking, you know, this is not a farming community. It's a city. You don't have animals there. Where did the rooster come from? But, you know, whichever is the case, it doesn't make any difference. Three times it happened, and three times he denied him. So Peter went out and wept bitterly, recognizing himself for a very great coward instead of the brave person that he thought he was. So he was shattered in his own eyes. And it happens to all of us one way or the other, you see. And that's why we should learn to be humble and meek, you know, and not boastful about, you know, "I'm so-and-so and I'm going to do this and that." And then, "No, not me. No, I'll never do that," you see. Should never be of that attitude, because there are certain circumstances in life that when we meet them, you know, then we really find out who we really are. And that's why even God says about us, like he did about Abraham, after he told him, and he did it, to literally go and sacrifice his son. And he was about to do it. And when he saw him wholeheartedly willing to do it, and was just about to do it, it's the time when he said, "Now I know." You see, didn't say that before that. Verse 63, "And now the man who held Jesus mocked him and beat him." There was no need to do it. He was innocent. What has he done? But, you know, you see the attitude again that enters into their minds and hearts. Again, demons are there at play, you know, at work, doing their job. That was a part of the process. And God gives them leave, you know, he gives them permission to go and do those kind of things. It's a part of the story, a part of the sacrifice. You see, the sacrifice of Jesus Christ began not when he was hanged on the cross, but when he was captured. That's when his sacrifice began. That's when his beating began. That's when his humiliation began. That's when they pulled, you know, the hair of his beard and smote him. You see? And some people forget that. And after that, in between came the most horrible scourging. The sacrifice of Jesus Christ was an ongoing one for a long time. You see, he was as good as dead when they caught him. And this was a reality here. But all that was from God. It was necessary. And so this is what they were doing to him. And having blindfolded him, You know, imagine that. Well, what need is there to blindfold him? They struck him on the face and asked him, saying, prophesy, who is the one who struck you? Now, these are all people that have seen him perform signs and wonders and miracles. Now, this is not a human behavior, normal human behavior, and unless the devil, you know, and his demons are involved there, you know, filling them with hatred and contempt and things like that, you know, normal people generally don't function like that. So, all that, again, was from God. It's a part of the sacrifice of Christ for his nation, for his people, and for all mankind. And so many other things that they blasphemously spoke against him. As soon as it was day, the elders of the people, both chief priests and scribes, came together and led him into their council, saying, because at night, as we read earlier, in other accounts, they already judged him guilty, but now, you know, they wait for the morning, because the reality was that he cannot pass a death sentence, which they were going to pass, unless the whole council was convening, and it could never be done at night. That's against the law, you know, that they had, law of the Sanhedrin. It had to be done during the day. And so, obviously, the final council that was going to condemn him, which they already did before the night, was going to be in the morning. And so this is what we read here. When the day came, they led him to the council, and they asked him, if you are the Christ, tell us. But he said to them, if I tell you, you will by no means believe. You know, what difference would it make whether I tell you or not? If by now, after all these, you know, years of ministry, 3 years that he was with them, and all the teachings that he gave them, if by now they cannot believe that, certainly are not going to believe at this point, because that was not what they were after. They were not after truth. Verse 68, and if I also ask you, you will by no means answer me or let me go. Hereafter the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God. You see, on the right hand. And this is where Stephen saw him when he saw him in a vision. He saw the Father seated, and right next to him, on the right hand, he saw Jesus Christ standing. You see? And for those in their ignorance and blindness, which is the overwhelming majority of those so-called, you know, Christians who believe in the Trinity, that's total nonsense. If God is three in one, what is he doing standing next to him? You see? Well, you know, they come up with all kinds of justifications to what it means. To begin with, why would he do, you know, what would he be doing, you know, on this earth? Totally separate from God, going through the pain and affliction and suffering, praying to the Father. You know, they're all three in one. This whole thing is total insanity, and people are so insane in their minds and their hearts, and they're not willing to acknowledge it. And so they say, well, it's a mystery. We don't understand it. Of course you don't understand it. It's a total nonsense and a total insanity. People would rather be insane than sane when this, you know, the light is shown to them. You know, they cover their eyes. They don't want to see the light. They prefer darkness. But there are days coming when God is going to open their eyes and they're going to see, as God said about his own people, when the time comes, he's going to open their eyes and they're going to loathe themselves for all the vomit that they swallowed, all the lies and deceptions, all the evil that they walked in. And this is one of them. And so this is what he's saying here. The Son of Man is going to be standing on the right, that is, he will sit on the right hand of the power of God. At this point, he's saying sitting. And oftentimes he's described as standing next to the Father. Then they all sit. In other words, what he's saying, you know, he's going to be sharing power with God. As later on he said in Revelation, he that overcomes shall sit with me on my throne as I overcame and sat on the throne of the Father. You see? And so here is the Father sitting, and then he's sitting next to him. In other words, sharing the power with him. And then you have all those who are going to become members of the body of Christ, the bride, they too are going to sit on the same seat. In other words, it's a metaphor for they're all going to share the power to govern and to rule and so forth. And verse 70, then they all said, are you then the Son of God? All this time they knew it, but they denied it. It was not convenient for them to acknowledge it, you see, because of the blindness that entered into their minds and hearts. And the rebellion, you know, against God to begin with, against the scriptures, well, they were not about to believe it. And so they ask him here at the last point, which they should have known to begin with, because All the multitudes knew that and acknowledged it. That wasn't a problem with the people, but, you know, this very few, power mad, hungry, you know, for power and covetousness, they were not about to submit to the truth. You know, they were not about to be confused with the truth. And so it is to this very day with many. And so he said to them, "You rightly say that I am." You know it. You acknowledge it. You see, a lot of people acknowledge many things, but they deny them anyway. And they're willing to accept it. You see, emotionally they are not willing to accept facts which they know to be facts. And all of us have that insanity in us. We oftentimes know the facts, we know the truth, but we deny them anyway. You know, for different reasons. Verse 71, and they said, "What further testimony do we need? For we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth." He acknowledged it. Why shouldn't he? You see, they should have acknowledged it too, like all the nations did. Why didn't they? Again, that was a part of the plan of God. Had they acknowledged it, obviously they would not have crucified him. So it was necessary to blind them, even though they otherwise knew the facts. But though, you know, even though they did it, they denied it. Just like Judas, you know, he knew that he was the Son of God. You see, he performed signs and wonders and miracles himself, that, you know, Christ gave all of them the power to do so as they went out. You know, they raised the dead, they healed the sick. They were all partakers of that. And yet it was necessary, in spite of all that, to blind his mind and his heart to the point where he was willing to betray him. It's not that he did not believe that he was the Son of God, you see. But all that was a part of the plan, and we have to appreciate it from that point of view, from the point of view of God. Yes, acknowledge the guilt, understand that, you see, but at the same time understand also the part of the plan of God that was there. And ultimately speaking, had those people not done what they have done, they would not have had, you know, a Savior, you see. And so I know when you comprehend that properly, then you begin to appreciate those kind of things in a different, totally different way. Chapter 23, then the whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate. That is, now the whole council is doing it. And it's not that every single one of them agreed with it. You see, there was just, you know, the vocal minority there that basically overcame all the others. And then, you know, the others just caved in. And still then, not everybody really went along with it. But that was a part of the plan of God, and it was going to happen one way or the other. And so they took him to Pilate. Why? Why would they take him to Pilate? You see, they could have killed him himself because, you know, of blasphemy, they could have done it. You see, they had the power to do it. Rome gave them in certain religious matters that concern their own religion, you know, and they allowed it to many other nationalities, you see. In their own religious matters, they allowed them to do what they was necessary to do. Why would they take him to Pilate? You see, because again, it was a plan of God that he should be crucified, and Jews don't crucify. You see? So how are you going to crucify Jesus Christ and nail him to the cross unless you get Rome involved, the Gentiles, because they too had their part. Why? Because the offering, the sacrifice, had to be offered both by Israel and the nations and the Gentiles. You see? And if you don't do it, the part of the eminent that wouldn't do it wouldn't get the benefits of the offering, of the sacrifice. That was, again, part of the plan of God. So it was necessary for all to be involved, because we have all sinned, and therefore, since all of us need redemption and salvation and a sacrifice and an offering, all had to be involved. There was no other way. All these things are not a coincidence. And so they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation," which he did not, "and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar," which he did not. And they all knew it very well. So now, you know, there are false accusations saying that he himself is the Christ, a king. You see? And I did not deny the fact that he's going to be, you know, sitting on the power of God, that he's a king, that he's a Messiah. So, you know, sort of mixing truth and error and perversion, you know, and twisting of the truth. And then Pilate asked him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Now, Pilate is not ignorant of all these matters. After all, you know, all these things are happening all the time. Everybody knows about it. You see, Romans and soldiers are already becoming a part of this movement, followers of Jesus Christ, like the centurion, you see, whose daughter he healed, Jesus Christ, and others who were involved. So it was not something that, you know, Pilate was not totally aware of. He fully comprehended and understood all these things, and he knew also He knew also the hypocrisy that was in those people that brought Jesus Christ to him. And so he's not about, you know, just fall for it. Then Pilate asked him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" He answered him and said, "It is as you say." That was a standard statement that Jesus Christ always used in answering people who knew what they were talking about and yet pretending like they did not really know it or believe it. You see? So in essence tells them, you know. Just like as you say. I don't need to tell you that. So Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowd, "I find no fault in this man." You see? Because he's a Roman. And he has to govern by Roman law. And this was a religious matter. And he had nothing to do with it. So there was nothing Rome could do about it. You see? And so Pilate said to the chief priests, "I find no fault in this man." But they were the more fierce, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee to this place." But still, teaching was not a crime, you see, as far as Rome was concerned. But then, you know, when they mentioned Galilee, which he should have known already about Galilee, but maybe he didn't think about it before that. When Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked if the man were a Galilean. Why is he saying that? Well, he wants to, wash his hands of this affair. You know, he doesn't want to get involved in that. Only if he's from Galilee, then, you know, he's a governor of Judea. He's not the governor of Galilee. And so he was going to send him to Herod, who was in charge of Galilee. That was the law of Rome. So as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod. And Herod just happened to be in town at the time. Why? Because Passover is there, and Herod is a Jew, even though he's an Edomite. But, you know, all the Edomites at that point were all converted Jews, that is, converted to Judaism. And so he was in town for the Passover. And so he sends him to Herod, who was also at Jerusalem at that time. And verse 8, "Now when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad," because, you know, here it is. He's going to see somebody who's going to perform signs and wonders for him. And mind you, this is the very one that killed John earlier. "For he had desired for a long time to see him, because he had heard many things about him, and he hoped to see some miracle done by him." That's why he was exceedingly glad to see him, not because he was going to follow him and obey him, worship him. And he himself should have known better, you see, because he knew the law of God. And he knew about the prophets, and he knew about the prophecies, and he knew about the coming of the Messiah. But he too, you know, was given to another spirit. Verse 9, "Then he questioned him with many words." And you can imagine that, all the questions that he asked him about the prophets, you see, about the teachings, about, you know, the prophecies, about him fulfilling it, and about the things that he had done, all kind of things like that. And he answered him nothing. And the chief priests and the scribes stood and vehemently accused him. Now, had he been honest and decent and really wanted to know truth, he would have given it to him. But as Christ warned us, "Do not give your pearls to a swine." You see, that means people who have no capacity to understand, to appreciate, and to act upon the things that you're going to tell them, don't waste your breath on them. It's not going to do them good. On the contrary, in many cases, it's going to do them a lot of harm. It's going to make them very angry and furious, you see. And it's not going to do them good. A lot of people just, you know, go and open their mouth and speak to everybody, standing on the corner streets and things like that. That's not the will of God. And yet a lot of people like to do their own thing. Well, anyway, in this case, it was very plain. Herod was that kind of a person. He was not able to comprehend, he was not able to believe, he was not interested in doing so, and Christ was not interested in speaking to him for that reason. And so we read in verse 9 again, "Then he questioned him," that is Herod, "with many words, but he answered him nothing," because there was nothing this person that could, you know, he could never understand anything anyway. He did not believe, he had no faith. This is not the reason why he wanted to see Christ or question him or listen to him. And the chief priests and scribes stood and vehemently accused him. Then Herod, with his men of war, treated him with contempt. On one hand, you know, he wants to see him. He knows that he's the one that performed all the signs and wonders and miracles. He's asking all kinds of questions. And then he shows his true colors. He treats him with contempt and mocked him and arrayed him in a gorgeous robe. You know, they took one of the robes of the king probably and just make fun of him and sent him back to Pilate. That's one reason. That's the main reason, in essence, why Christ was not about to give him any answer, because he knew what kind of a person he's standing against, which basically a person that acted like a swine. Verse 12, that very day Pilate and Herod became friends with each other, which is a very foolish thing. And oftentimes it happens like that, you know, your enemy, you know, and my enemy, you know, that makes us friends. In this case, you know, that's just a, what an irony. What a travesty, you know, some would say. And so that we became friends with each other. You know, obviously they had previous conflicts and frictions over authority and jurisdiction and things like that. And of all things, you see, and of all things, when the Son of Man, when the Creator, when the Redeemer stands there, when the one who is going to give them life and redemption stands before them, their animosity or their mockery or their contempt for him, and both of them are responsible, in essence, of what was going to happen to him along with the Jewish priesthood. And so that is a cause for them for friendship. And obviously, this is what the way, you know, the Bible would call the friendship of the world. And those who seek the friendship of the world are enemies of God, as later on the Apostle John would write. So for previously, they had been at enmity with each other. Then Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, so now he again is convening that session there to make sure that, you know, maybe they can find out something different against Jesus Christ, because the law of Rome constrained him. He could not really sentence him to anything because he hasn't done anything. He would have had to justify it before Caesar. And so he's trying, you know, other ways. So he said to them, "Ye have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence, I found no fault in this man concerning those things of which you accuse him." So in essence, he's exposing them, but he's also exposing himself, because what he did later on shows the hypocrisy of this statement. If you found him in the presence of all these witnesses to be without fault, why do you scourge him and then crucify him? You see? So the hypocrisy was everywhere, and the mockery and the contempt. But then all those things were orchestrated by God, and he's using unclean spirits to that end, and he's using human beings, because all of them needed to be involved in that. And all of them, in essence, you know, like Pilate and Herod, you know, for the government of Galilee where Christ was, and Herod, you know, the government of the Gentiles, representative of it, and the priesthood representative of Israel, Judah, you know, all of them, in essence, had to lay their hands symbolically on the head of the lamb of the sacrifice, confessing their sins without realizing this is, in essence, what they were doing, and offering him, and God accepted the sacrifice, and their sins were going to be forgiven. So in spite of them, in spite of their actions, and in spite of their mockery and contempt, God was going to bring redemption out of it for them. For it is to that end that he sent him, and to that end Jesus Christ gave his life. Now this is not human. Only God can work out this kind of details, and human beings looking at that, being involved, you know, present, eyewitnesses right there, or aware of what's happening, they could not see what is really happening here. And that's the way we function today also. When God is going to bring horrible punishment on Israel, as it was in days of old, you know, people just look at the players right in front of them, and they look at the moves of this nation or that nation or these people and that people, and they begin to search out and find all kind of conspiracies, all kind of things, anything but to ascend to the throne of God and to see all things from his point of view, and who is really in charge of all these things. Who is orchestrating it? Who is pulling the strings? Who is behind it? We are just the instruments. of good and of evil. And God is using, you know, good people and bad people to bring out his plan into fruition. And we have to learn to look at things, everything in life, from God's point of view. As the men of old who were faithful always saw it from that point of view. And you see so many examples when all kind of things happen. People who were men of faith, women of faith, knew God did it. You see, God caused this and God had done that. And of course, God is not necessarily doing everything. But there are many things that when we are in tune with the Spirit of God, with the law of God, with the knowledge of God, you see, especially, you know, major events like that, we begin to understand. This is not, you know, what is happening, it's not what it is. You see, there is something behind it. And we have to see God in all that, to the end that he may bring salvation and redemption to Pilate, to Herod, to the priesthood, to Judah, to Israel, to every human being who ever lived upon the face of the earth, whose name is written in the book of life. And only God knows exactly which are the ones whose names are written in the book of life. Some people may think that they are, you see, and they are enemies of God and they are going to end up somewhere else. And we shall stop at this point. This is again Mordecai Joseph, greetings to all of God's people. Until the next lesson.